This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good afternoon. I'm going to ask our ushers to close the doors. And I want to welcome you and also apologize that we are starting a little late. As many of you know, because there was a class in here, and the staff of Campbell Hall did an amazing job transforming a classroom into the auditorium that we're going to use this afternoon. Let me say a word or two about questions. While Ambassador Ross is presenting, our students will be distributing to you 3x5 cards and pencils. And if you have questions, please write the questions down. And probably at about 4:15, the students will be in the aisles. You should pass them to your right. And they will pick them up here, there, and over by the wall. Also, because of our friends at the Book Den, we have Dennis's new book, Doomed to Succeed, the U.S.-Israel Relationship from Truman to Obama. I should tell you that Dennis Ross, of course, is no stranger to us, right? How many of you heard Ambassador Ross in the past? A lot of hands go up, a lot. And I think he's I think this is his third visit as a Taubman speaker, and his fourth, if you include a seminar that he gave for the Walter H. Capp Center as well. So we know Dennis, and Dennis knows us, and we're here, as in the past, to learn from an extraordinary man and his new book. The book that we're here to listen to learn about from Ambassador Ross is a unique book. There is no book that I'm aware of that covers this relationship as thoroughly as Dennis Ross does in this book. Secondly, some historians have written bits and pieces of this, but a diplomat has an entirely different perspective. And consequently, this is a really unique opportunity for us to learn about the Israel-U.S. relationship from a diplomat who has been there in the existential kishkas, if you will, of this relationship. Kishkas means like, you know, your guts, something like that. So, without any further ado, please join me in greeting our very good friend, Ambassador Dennis Ross.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Obviously, there's not a lot for me to talk about right now. But I'll find a way to say something. I do want to start just with, and I will link this to the book. I do want to start with what's going on right now. Look, the ISIS is obviously not contained. ISIS is obviously able to organize and use the space that it now controls in Syria, more Syria than Iraq, to plan operations, to carry out operations. I'm not sure that what happened in Mali today was done by ISIS or if it was done by Al-Qaeda or if we now have a kind of competition between the two to see who can create more of an impact or who can be more disruptive. But what we're seeing is something that reflects a lot of organization, the ability to carry off complicated kinds of terrorist attacks is going to be the sort of thing that I think we will see for some time to come, until, in fact, they are removed from their strongholds where they're really able to create what some people have referred to as a kind of factory for terrorists. We're going to see more and more of this. I can get in the Q&A if we want. I can get into what are the ways we might try to contend with this. But I would say it also has an impact in a kind of perverse way on what we've seen recently and is continuing within Israel. And by that I mean we have seen an act of individualized terror. I say individualized terror because it doesn't look like the first two intifadas. The first two intifadas were highly organized. There was a leadership, there was affiliation, there was a structure. There was, in a sense, planning that went on. A lot of what we've seen now and for the last several months, these are acts of individuals, not connected to organizations. Most of them are between the ages of 15 and 25. They are carrying out, for the most part, highly intimate forms of terror. What I mean by that is, when you're stabbing somebody, this is a highly intimate form of terror. Literally, it's bloodletting. It's not like what you saw in Paris or what you saw what happened today in Mali. I mean, that's where, in a sense, you know, people come in and they, you know, they open fire in this kind of a setting. You know, there's almost an abstraction to it. This is not abstract. This is highly personal. And it is, in a sense, nothing is more appropriately defined as terror than this, particularly the way it's been done. It is interesting that when the Obama administration initially reacted to it, it called for calm and an end to the cycle of violence. Now, there have been periods where you've seen exchanges of violence, for sure. This was actually not one of those. This was a case where you began to see stabbings take place. And as I said, most of it was a result of incitement through social media. Most of it was a result of a false narrative that was being promoted in social media and by parts of the Palestinian Authority about Israel changing the status quo on, for the Muslims, the Haram al-Sharif, for the Jews, the Temple Mount. And the Israelis were not changing the status quo on the Temple Mount. And yet that was being promoted in a way that many of those who were responsible for the stabbings, if they weren't killed and they were arrested, or even if they were about to commit this act of terror, they were saying this was for Al-Aqsa. They were protecting the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the Haram. And if you look at where does this sort of anger and the, you know, the response to a false narrative come from, in a strange way, it comes from the fact several, like I, let me put it this way, it comes from several different sources of anger and frustration. One, and it relates to what I was just talking about in terms of what we're seeing with ISIS, you have ISIS as part of what is a series of conflicts in the Middle East right now. You have a proxy war, largely between Saudi Arabia and Iran and Syria. You have a proxy war also between them in Yemen. You have the war with ISIS in Iraq and parts of Syria. Now you have ISIS doing what it's doing internationally. And in the world and in the region, no one was paying attention to Palestinians. So Palestinians, particularly young Palestinians, were reacting in part, at least, to the fact that the Arab world is not paying any attention to them. The international community is not paying any attention to them. In addition to that, they look at their own leadership, and there's a recent Palestinian poll that shows that 80% of the Palestinian public believes that the Palestinian Authority is corrupt. 66% want Abu Mazen to resign. And what this highlights, obviously, is real alienation from a Palestinian leadership that doesn't look to be effective, doesn't look to be relevant, tends to be focused more on symbols and the substance of changing the reality for Palestinians. And thirdly, obviously, there's a lot of anger at the Israelis. They see Israeli actions, which they see as indicating there's no possibility of ever having a state. The combination of all three of these things were what produces. Now, as I said, what you saw were very intimate forms of terror, but the administration's reaction to it was to call for calm and an end to the cycle of violence. Now, there actually was no cycle of violence. There were just acts of terror. The reason that there was this kind of instinct in the administration to call for an end to the cycle of violence was because of what I'll call a mindset. And the mindset was a mindset that says, well, you can't somehow be condemning only the Palestinians. If you condemn only the Palestinians, that'll create a backlash. And we won't look like we're, in a sense, being even-handed. There was this instinct, this fear, that somehow if you simply referred to it as terror and simply referred to the incitement that was driving it, that somehow that would create a problem with Palestinians, that would create a problem with the Arabs. Now the mindset, the reason I highlight this for you is the mindset has been a mindset in every administration from Truman to Obama. It has been the mindset or approach of a constituency that has existed in every administration from Truman to Obama. All right, so now I have your attention, right? So, because I also teach, and because the way I like to teach is by asking questions, I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to engage you in this, partly because it makes it more interesting for me. I want you to be interested, but it's very important for me to be interested. I'm going to pique your interest in the book in the process. So I just said, in every administration from Truman to Obama, there has been a constituency in the national security apparatus that has looked at Israel basically through a lens of Israel being a problem, not a partner, and that there was a need to be very sensitive to Arab attitudes. So every administration had this constituency. Every administration had a constituency that saw Israel as a problem, not a partner. So the question to you is, in which administration did this constituency have no influence? Okay, they existed in every administration, but there's one where they had no influence. Which one was it?
Nixon.
Nixon? No.
Eisenhower?
I understand, I'm saying this is a constituency that saw Israel as a problem, not a partner.
Bush
43.
No, Carter.
Carter? Who said Carter? This is a constituency that saw Israel as a problem, and they had no weight. Okay, they had no weight. Who guessed Bush 43? All right, Bush 43 is a very good guess. In fact, it's an excellent guess. It's wrong, but it's a really excellent guess. And I'll tell you why it's an excellent guess. If President Obama was here, you know, he might have made the same guess. And in fact, in July of 2009, when President Obama was meeting with a group of Jewish leaders, one of the Jewish leaders said to him that if you want Israel to move on peace, you really need to be right next to it. They need to know that you're there. They need to know that you have their back. You need to have your arm around them. Okay, you can get it. It's not for me. All right. So he said, you know, for 8 years, this is what President Obama said, which is why the guess is a good one. He said, for 8 years, there has been no daylight between the Bush administration and the Israelis. And what did that get us? The Israelis sat on the sideline, and it cost us with the Arabs. So he clearly thought that there had been no daylight, meaning that the constituency that saw Israel as a problem had no influence. Now, first, it was bad history, because, in fact, during that 8 years, when you had Bush, you had Ariel Sharon, who didn't sit on the sidelines. He unilaterally withdrew Israeli settlements and soldiers from Gaza. I mean, it was precisely because he felt close to Bush he was prepared to take what was a unilateral withdrawal from Gaza, and actually he withdrew from 4 settlements in the West Bank. And in 2008, you had Ehud Olmert, who went beyond the Clinton parameters in terms of presenting a proposal to solve the conflict, to try to break through everything. Now, that wouldn't have happened again had it not been for his sense of how close Bush was to the Israelis. So the idea that closeness led the Israelis to sit on the sideline was wrong, because actually they did take 2 big initiatives. Now, the reason that the answer that Bush is not the administration where this constituency had no weight is because Bush, after 9/11, after he declares a war on terror, in his first call to Ariel Sharon, is pressing Sharon to have his foreign minister, then Shimon Peres, meet Yasser Arafat. Now, understand, take a look at this context. He has declared a war on terror. He wouldn't dream of having us talk to those responsible for 9/11. And yet, Israel, which is experiencing bombs at the same time, real terror, and the guy who bears clear responsibility for this is Arafat, he's pressing to have the Israelis meet with Arafat. And the reason is there's a constituency in the State Department and the intelligence community that convinces him that 9/11 is because we were too close to Israel. 9/11 is because there's no, there's no resolution of the Palestinian problem, and that we can't get any partners in the war on terror unless we solve the Palestinian problem. So that constituency that saw Israel as the problem had a lot of weight, enough weight that even after 9/11, this is what Bush is pushing Sharon to do. Now, it is true that Bush evolves. It is true that over time his attitude towards Israel becomes different, and he limits. He becomes close to Israel. In fact, so much so that he gives a speech in May of 2008 to the Knesset in his last year. He doesn't go to Israel until 2008. He goes to Israel in May of 2008, and he gives a speech in which he says, "You may think you're 7 million, but in truth, you're 307 million because of the United States." So Bush does evolve, and the war on terror does have an impact on him, but this constituency I was describing obviously had significant weight, enough that they could affect what he had to say to Sharon after 9/11, number one. And number two, they had enough weight throughout the course of the administration that from time to time, when you read the Bush chapter in the book, as you all will, when you read the Bush chapter in the book, you'll see that there's different points where they emerge, and again, particularly during the Lebanon War in 2006, you'll see again signs of their influence. Okay, so it isn't Bush 43, so I owe you an answer, right? I have to tell you, so which administration was it in which the constituency existed but had no influence? It's Bill Clinton. Now, it is true that I was Clinton's negotiator, so maybe that had something to do with it. But in truth, the real reason is different. The real reason is that Clinton believed that the United States was Israel's only friend. And as Israel's only friend, we could not afford to allow a gap to be opened between the United States and Israel. Because if we did that, it would encourage Israel's enemies and it would weaken Israel's deterrent. And from Clinton's standpoint, our job was to ensure that Israel's deterrent was stronger, not weaker. Okay? All right, so you like this process of Q&A? I mean, the one good news for you is that any question I pose, I can answer. All right, so let me ask another one. All right, so which administration do you think was the toughest on Israel? From Truman to Obama, which was the toughest on Israel? Obama? Bush 1? Carter? Who said Eisenhower? Eisenhower's right. Eisenhower comes in, and Eisenhower believes that Truman had made the decision to recognize Israel only for political reasons, and that our real interests in the region, and he and John Foster Dulles believe that the Middle East is the key to, in a sense, the competition with the Soviets. And we have to, in his mind, we have to follow what are our fundamental real interests, and those lie with the Arabs. And he thinks that Truman did just the opposite. Now, the reason he thinks Truman did just the opposite is because all of the senior national security advisors, the cabinet officials, were all against the recognition of the State of Israel. George C. Marshall was the Secretary of State, Forrestal was the Secretary of Defense, George Kennan, who was the author of Containment. All of those who were the key people in shaping the institutions in the Cold War, the people who were referred to in a book that was written called The Wise Men, it subsequently became known as The Wise Men, all of them opposed recognition of the State of Israel, and yet Truman recognizes Israel over their opposition. And Eisenhower believes that must have been done only because of political reasons. It must have been done only because of the weight of the Jews. In fact, when you read the Eisenhower chapter, as you all will, when you read the Eisenhower chapter, you'll see in one place where that John Foster Dulles says, George C. Marshall and Forrestal tried to have a policy not run by the Jews. We're going to succeed in doing that. So this is very much the mindset when they come in, and they adopt policies accordingly. Now, one indication of this when they come in is that shortly after Eisenhower becomes president, Israel is drawing water from the Jordan River for irrigation and also for hydroelectric purposes. And when the Arabs complain about it, Eisenhower suspends the loans that Truman had made. Truman did maintain an arms embargo on Israel throughout the life of his administration, but he did provide loans and some grant assistance. Not a huge amount, but he still did that. And Eisenhower is one of his first acts when the Israelis draw on Jordan River water. When the Arabs don't like it, he suspends the loans to Israel. Just to put this in perspective, Israel between 48 and 1951 has to absorb a population primarily of Jews from the Arab world who were forced to leave with no assets. In Egypt and certainly in Baghdad and Cairo, you had significant Jewish populations. They were very wealthy populations. They were forced to leave with no assets. And Israel's population literally doubles from 600,000 at the time of the 1948 war. By 51, it's up to 1.2 million. Almost all of these are coming from the Arab world. Israel at the time is desperately in need of economic assistance. At the time, it never has more than 1 week's supply of food on hand. It gives you a sense of how poor Israel was. And Eisenhower suspends loans to Israel because they're drawing water from the Jordan River in light of Arab complaints. So that's one indication that he was going to change things. The proof of this becomes much stronger, though, in time. John Foster Dulles, who I've already indicated what his attitudes were, in May of 53, he takes a trip. He takes a trip to the Middle East for 3 weeks. Everywhere he goes, he says, we are going to pursue America's national interests in the Middle East, unlike what Truman did. And our interests lie with the Arabs. I mean, what I'm paraphrasing here, this is what he said. Now, in his first stop is in Lebanon. And his first stop, he sees the president of Lebanon, and he says to him, our policy is going to be different. You'll see, we're not going to depend on domestic political factors, unlike Truman, and we will counter Israeli aggression. I'm actually quoting from the Memcon of the meeting. We will counter Israeli aggression. So I have a question for you. Did Israel have occupied territories at this point?
No.
Israel's at its narrowest point at this time. Israel is 9 miles wide. At the time, every country around Israel rejects its existence, and every country, interestingly enough, except Lebanon, has fedayin, meaning self-sacrificers, carrying out terror raids from Egypt, from Syria, from Jordan. And by the way, the Arab Legion, which is at that time financed by the British and seconded British as officers, headed up. From all these areas, you have fedayin raids into Israel. And Dulles says, we will counter Israeli aggression. Pretty remarkable. Now, it gets in 1956, there's a Suez War, and Israel, with British and French backing, because after Nasser nationalizes the Suez Canal, they both want to see Nasser upended. They want Nasser to be dealt a setback. And so they actually support the Israelis going in. They come up with what is, when you read the chapter, you'll see a kind of cockamamie plan. That's a technical term for it. But they, in a sense, are in league supporting the Israelis. Eisenhower, in response to the Israelis going into the Sinai and going to the Suez Canal, Eisenhower actually has us present a Security Council resolution. And in the Security Council resolution, it calls on all nations to stop contacts with Israel, stop any assistance to Israel. The British and the French actually veto that resolution. It is the only resolution they will ever veto, protecting Israel, but nonetheless they veto it. Eisenhower then threatens sanctions against Israel. He has his Undersecretary of State, Herbert Hoover, Jr., threaten the Israelis with expulsion from the UN. Now it's Hoover because Dulles, a couple days into the war, suffers an acute abdominal attack, which turns out to be cancer, and so he's not there, he's in the hospital, but here's Herbert Hoover doing this. And it's symptomatic of the approach to the Israelis. For the life of the Eisenhower administration, the Israelis will request arms from the Eisenhower administration, from the president. And this is at a time when the Soviets are now significantly supplying arms to Egypt, supplying arms to Syria, and after the coup in Iraq in 1958, to Iraq as well. And the response of the Eisenhower administration to the Israelis is, you should seek the goodwill of your neighbors. Now, these are all neighbors who reject Israel's existence. So Eisenhower is the toughest on Israel, very clearly. What is interesting is it's true that Eisenhower never suspends arms to the Israelis because, in fact, he never provides any arms to the Israelis. There is an administration that does suspend arms to Israel as a punishment. I'll give you a hint by saying Even before I asked the question, you're answering it. I was going to say it was we suspended the shipment of F-16s to Israel as a punishment. In a minute, I'll say there's another administration that suspends armed shipments, but not as a punishment. But one administration suspends F-16s deliveries to Israel as a punishment for Israeli behavior. So one guess here was the first Bush. Any other guesses?
No, it was Ronald Reagan.
It was Ronald Reagan. That's correct. You have one of the answers right. It is after Israel bombs the Osirik reactor in Iraq, the U.S. suspends F-16s to Israel, and the president will do it again at the end of the year when Menachem Begin extends Israeli law and administration to the Golan Heights. So he suspends F-16s to Israel twice as a punishment. It is true, later on, Reagan comes to believe that maybe it wasn't such a bad idea that the Israelis took out the Osirik reactor in Iraq. But at the time, he suspends F-16s. That's actually not the low point in the Reagan administration. The low point is during the siege of Beirut, during the summer of 1982, and then what happens in Sabra and Shatila after the PLO, these are refugee camps after the PLO withdraws. During the summer, Reagan actually threatens the future of the relationship on multiple occasions, multiple times. That really is the low point of the Reagan administration, and yet it is the Reagan administration that is the administration that transforms the relationship between Israelis and Palestinians. I mean, transforms the relationship between the United States and Israel in a fundamental way. It is the Reagan administration, it is President Reagan, who presides over the creation of an institutional structure of cooperation on military-to-military ties, on defense industry ties, on intelligence ties, even on economic ties. It is Reagan who creates an institutional structure that every president after Reagan inherits and actually builds on. It's Reagan. And he does it starting in January of 1984. He authorizes the creation of something called the Joint Political Military Group, and that is basically the embryo of what becomes strategic cooperation and strategic partnership with Israel. Now, the reason for the change from 82 to 84 is that Israel agrees in an accord that George Shultz brokers to withdraw from Lebanon if the Syrians will do so. The Syrians had promised in 1982 when the Israelis had inflicted a defeat on them, broken the Beirut to Damascus Highway, imposed a siege on Beirut, destroyed a good chunk of the Syrian Air Force. The Syrians at that point had promised to get out if the Israelis would get out by May of 83. This is September 82. By May of 83, things have changed because the Soviets have rebuilt the Syrian military. They are manning the air defense of Syria. The Iranians have created Hezbollah by using the Revolutionary Guard in Lebanon. We lose 241 Marines in the bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut. And Reagan goes back to his roots. Reagan goes back to his instincts. Reagan had, during World War II, had been responsible for doing training films. And as in that position, he was among the first to see the films of the liberation of the death camps. And he is so moved by that, he actually keeps the films. He tells George Shultz, when George Shultz is Secretary of State, he still has the films because what he saw was so awful, he felt they needed to be saved because he thought people wouldn't actually believe what had happened. It creates for Reagan a moral conviction that we have a responsibility to Israel and we have to live up to it. Now, notwithstanding that, for the first 2 years, he was prepared to inflict punishments on Israel. His Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberg, in the summer of 1982, during the siege of Beirut, actually wanted us to break relations with Israel. And Reagan doesn't permit that, but he does, in fact, suspend arms deliveries. By 84, everything has changed. He's gone back to his roots, and the Reagan administration becomes a transforming administration. Now, it's transforming in one other important respect. In the Reagan administration, for the first time, you see a counter-constituency emerge within the national security apparatus that sees Israel as a partner, not as a problem. I said in every administration, you have a constituency from Truman up until today that sees Israel as a problem. Starting with Reagan, you begin to see a countervailing constituency. And from Reagan on in administrations, you see a bit of a tussle between these two constituencies. And a lot, the balance between them depends very much on who the president is and the president's attitudes. Now, what I want to do is talk a little bit about the assumptions that have guided the constituency that saw Israel as a problem. There have been three, and they have been deeply embedded. They're so deeply embedded that I think those who believe in this don't even think about it. It's kind of like a given. These are kind of implicit assumptions, but they're there. And they're three, and they're interrelated. The first one is that if you distance from Israel, you will gain with the Arabs. The second is, it's a corollary, if you cooperate with Israel, you'll lose with the Arabs. And the third is, if you want to transform the American position in the Middle East, and you want to transform the Middle East itself, you have to solve the Palestinian problem. These three assumptions are embedded in the constituency I've described. The third one is shared by some who also see Israel as a partner, not just a problem. And what I want to do is give you a little bit of a sense of how these assumptions played out on policy, and then I'll draw it to a conclusion by bringing it up to today. What is interesting is I've already given you one example on the idea of distancing and you gain from the Arabs, right? Because I start off by describing that President Obama said, look, for 8 years there was no daylight, and the Israelis stood pat and we lost with the Arabs. So that's an example of that, but it's not the most egregious example of that. But it is an indicator, it's a reminder, there were five administrations that thought if you distance from Israel, you would gain with the Arabs. Eisenhower, Nixon, Carter, Bush 41, and Obama. In no case do we actually gain with the Arabs. But I'll give you what I think is the most egregious example to start with. In March of 1970, Richard Nixon suspends F-4 Phantoms to Israel, not as a punishment. Unlike what Reagan did, which is a punishment, he suspends F-4 Phantoms to Israel because he's trying to reach out to Nasser. Nixon, interestingly enough, believes the 1967 war was a defeat for the United States. When you read the Nixon chapter, you'll see why he believes that's the case, but you'll have to read the chapter to find that out. He suspends the F-4 Phantoms to Israel because he thinks this is a way to gain with Nasser. And Nasser will see this is a great gesture. Now, what makes it egregious is that the very moment he does this is at the time that the Soviets, for the first time, are making a decision to send their military personnel outside the Soviet bloc, outside the Warsaw Pact. They send 10,000 Soviet military personnel forces to Egypt to take over Egypt's air defense. This is the very moment that Nixon chooses to suspend arms sales to Israel in the hopes that this will attract Nasser. He sends his Undersecretary of State to see Nasser. He's fully expecting Nasser to be doing handstands. And what do you think Nasser's response is? Does Nasser say, gee, that's really great. Boy, we really appreciate it. What a great gesture. No, Nasser ups his demands. So we distance from Israel at this very moment, and all it produces is increased demands from Nasser, nothing positive. All right, what about the second assumption, that if we cooperate with Israel, that we'll lose with the Arabs? All right, so the first administration to provide arms to Israel happens to be the Kennedy administration. And the arms that they provide are Hawk anti-aircraft missiles. It's a purely defensive weapon system. It's designed solely to be able to protect against attacking aircraft. Now it triggers, before the president finalizes the decision, it triggers a very heated debate within the administration. And the leading opponent of it is Dean Rusk, who's the Secretary of State, who says, if we provide arms to Israel, understand, we haven't provided arms to Israel yet. This is 1962. He says, if we provide arms to Israel, it'll set a terrible precedent and it will do grave damage to our relationship with the Arabs. Now, as luck would have it for Dean Rusk, this decision leaks out the same day he's meeting the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Crown Prince Faisal, who in fact at the time is actually the real leader in Saudi Arabia. He will soon replace the king. So here's Rusk walking in to see him, and after all, he said, terrible precedent, grave damage with the Arabs. So does Faisal go after him and say, how could you do that? You obviously don't want friendship with us. Is that what Faisal's focused on? Is this what Faisal addresses? It's a pregnant pause. You're on the edge of your seats. No, he doesn't even raise it. What does he raise? He raises a Nasser-backed coup in Yemen, which he says is a threat to Saudi Arabia because Nasser's trying to get a foothold in the Arabian Peninsula. And he says, we need American assurances, we need American arms. This is what he raises. Okay, he sees 1 week later President Kennedy. So maybe in the intervening period, you know, it dawned on him, wait, yeah, the U.S. is providing arms to Israel. So when he comes in to see President Kennedy, does he go after President Kennedy? Does he say, you obviously don't want friendship with Saudi Arabia because you're providing arms to Israel? Does he do that?
No.
It's a rhetorical question. No, what does he focus on? He comes into the president and he says to him, your outreach to Egypt is threatening all your friends in the region. Your economic assistance to Egypt, at the time, we're providing two-thirds of the Egyptian bread supply. He says, your economic assistance to Egypt is freeing up resources to threaten your friends and change the regional balance of power against us. We need American assurances and we need American arms. Now, every chapter in the book is about a different administration, and in every chapter, what I do is I highlight issues where you see that there will be echoes that reverberate over time. Now, did this exchange I just described between Faisal and President Kennedy, does it sound familiar to you? Do you think that we've had more recent conversations that sound like that? If you substitute the word Iran for Egypt, isn't that exactly the conversation we've been having with the Saudis for the last year, both before the Iran nuclear deal and after the Iran nuclear deal? That's also a rhetorical question. The answer is yes. That's exactly what's been going on. It's literally the same conversation. What it highlights, what these two examples and the assumptions highlight, is that what matters to Arab leaders, what is their main preoccupation, is their security and their survival. They don't see Israel as a threat to that. I'm not saying they love Israel. I'm not saying that oftentimes they might not be put on the defensive because of Israel. But they don't see Israel as a threat to them. And they never will make their relationship with the United States dependent on what we do with the Israelis. And they haven't done that. All right? Now, what about the third assumption? The third assumption, which is you can't transform the American position in the region, you can't transform the region itself unless you solve the Palestinian issue. Now, you're looking at someone who spent the last 30 years of his life trying to solve this issue. The truth is, I take a backseat to no one in terms of trying to resolve it, but I never tried to resolve it because I thought it was going to transform the region, that it was going to be a game changer in the region. I tried to do it because it was the right thing to do. I tried to do it because a two-state outcome is actually in Israel's interest. If you think a one-state outcome is in Israel's interest, look at what you have today. This is what you're going to see in the future. Ongoing conflict of this sort. So I have been in favor of trying to resolve this conflict because we should try to resolve this conflict. We don't need one more problem in the region, but not because this will change the region. If tomorrow we could resolve this, it wouldn't stop one barrel bomb in Syria. It wouldn't move ISIS back 1 meter. It wouldn't end the existential struggle that's going on within Egypt today between President Sisi, the Muslim Brotherhood, and Islamists. It wouldn't stop the proxy war in Yemen. It wouldn't somehow allow Libya to be congealed as a state. It won't change the region. It should be pursued on its own merits, but it won't transform the region. Now, these assumptions have been embedded over time, even though reality basically invalidates them. A lot of the reason for writing the book was to expose that. But there's another reason. Look, the title of the book is called Doomed to Succeed. It's not doomed to succeed, question mark. We've seen a relationship where there are tensions, where there are differences, but there's always a tendency to build on the relationship and move it in the right direction afterwards. And there's a reason for that. Fundamentally, Israel is the only democracy in the region. Fundamentally, we share values with Israel. We share interests with Israel. We have shared threats. Those who threaten them tend to threaten us and vice versa. And when you look at this region now, whatever the differences that have existed in this administration, and you'll see when you read the Obama chapter, as you all will, what you'll see is that Obama, on the one hand, has been very good when it comes to the issue of Israeli security, but when it comes to the Palestinian issue, he sees Israel as strong and the Palestinians as weak. And therefore, he put all the onus on the Israelis. And he had no hesitancy to distance from Israel because he thought it would gain us benefits, which it did not. Notwithstanding those differences, the fact of the matter is the relationship will continue to improve. And it will, because look at the region. Look at the rest of the region. The state system, the Arab state system in the Middle East right now is under threat. The reason that the violence in the Middle East is so terrible, the conflicts are so terrible, is because it's over something as basic as identity. When you're fighting to determine who controls identity, nothing is more basic, nothing is more fundamental. And that's why the violence is so terrible. It isn't going to change soon, because a struggle over identity isn't going to go away overnight. So contrast that reality, contrast what looks like an unraveling in the Middle East, to one country that actually has institutions. There is one country in the Middle East that has a rule of law, a separation of powers, an independent judiciary. There is one country in the Middle East that actually has freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of the press. There is one country in the Middle East where women's rights are respected, where gay rights are respected, where there is artistic freedom. There is one country like that, and that country is Israel. And it's precisely because of those institutions Israel will be able to cope, even with difficulty, with its problems. And it's because of those institutions that its basic orientation will remain the same. And it's because of those institutions that I entitled the book, Doomed to Succeed. I'll stop there.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that this was an extraordinary presentation that we've just heard from Ambassador Ross. And I'd like to pose a question, because at the beginning you talked a bit about ISIS, Daesh, et cetera. But as a diplomat, how do you understand these events that transpired a week ago in Paris and what is happening in Paris or in France,
right,
and in Western Europe as a result of that?
Look, what I see is a threat that was underestimated. I mean, think about the following. You know, France was on a state of high alert since last January because of Charlie Hebdo. And because of that, you know, they instituted at times more expansive powers for their security forces. And yet, here was an attack that was highly coordinated, highly choreographed, involving probably more than nine people. We know seven people initially were the ones who were killed. We now know there were two additional ones who have subsequently been killed. But in addition to that, my guess is there was probably a larger circle of people. So usually, the larger the circle of people, the more likely you're going to be exposed. And yet, notwithstanding a very professional intelligence corps, notwithstanding a very professional security organization, the fact is this came as a strategic surprise. So the first thing I understand is that the holes in the security intelligence apparatus were much more pronounced than the French understood or that we understood. And the first thing we should be doing is asking, okay, how could this kind of attack have taken place? How many more might have been involved? What are the holes we have to fill in the approach to security, number one? Number two, what do we have to do to disrupt ISIS and its ability to plan operations in Syria, which is where they're doing this, meaning, you know, the key to ensuring that groups like ISIS can't carry out these kind of attacks is to have them so preoccupied with their own security that they don't have the time, space, or luxury to be planning attacks of this sort. So our focus in terms of ratcheting up military pressure on them by us, by the French, by others, has to be geared towards thinking through how military operations can relate to that. The third thing I think of is you really do have to have a coherent strategy for Syria, which we still don't have, because even at the very moment that we're ratcheting up attacks against ISIS, the Russians are still primarily bombing the non-ISIS opposition. So it means we're going after ISIS, which is Sunni. They're going after primarily the non-ISIS Sunni opposition within Syria. It looks like if we continue on that basis, we would then be in league with the Russians, the Syrians, and the Iranians at a time when you have this Sunni-Shia divide, it looks like we're taking part in a war on the Sunnis. Rather than discrediting ISIS, that might actually bolster ISIS, and it will mean the Sunnis who you need to discredit them won't be available. They will distance themselves from this. So a more coherent response has to also find a way to create leverage on Russia to change its approach at a minimum to go after only ISIS. And I think that requires us to think in terms of leverage, which we have not really been thinking about when it comes to the Russians.
Thank you very much, Dennis. I have in front of me a handful of really excellent questions. And so may I start with questions from our colleagues in the audience?
Sure.
And I want to start with this one that reads, have your views on the U.S.-Israeli relation changed over the years? And if you answer yes, this person asks, how and how much?
My views on the U.S.-Israeli relationship have really not changed over the years. I have been in that constituency that saw Israel as a partner, and that the best way to promote things with the Israelis, including to manage differences with them, was by being a more collaborative relationship with them as opposed to a more competitive one. These two constituencies I'm describing are those who see Israel as a problem and therefore tend to take a less collaborative approach versus those who see Israel as a partner and therefore take more of a collaborative approach. And I've been in that more collaborative approach. One of the things I point out in the Obama chapter is that there was an interesting difference between the first term versus the second term, at least in part because when Tom Donilon was the National Security Advisor, and obviously I was there, the approach towards the Israelis tended to be much more collaborative, certainly after the first 6 months of the administration. When Donilon left in July 1, 2013, and was replaced by Susan Rice, the approach became much more competitive. Some of the differences on Iran were magnified because there were misunderstandings that might not have taken place had you maintained a more collaborative approach.
This is a very interesting question, and the person who asked this was very, very smart, I think. And the question goes like this: how much does the Nobel Peace Prize impact President Obama's decision-making process? Now, before you answer that question, could I add just a little bit to it?
Absolutely.
Because, there are other people who have won the Peace Prize on both the Israeli and the Palestinian sides.
Yeah.
So does the Nobel Peace Prize affect the situation?
I don't think so. If you go back, I mean, one of the more interesting speeches that President Obama gave was a speech that he gave when he accepted the Nobel Prize. And he actually used that speech at the end of 2009 to provide a justification for the use of force. It was kind of counterintuitive. So it really, I don't see it being connected very much to the relationship. It did not affect him. What really did affect him, as I said, over time, he used to say in my presence throughout the first term, when it comes to Israel, whatever our differences are, we fence off security. And I think he meant that. But his differences were much more in the realm, as I said, of how to deal with the peace issue. And here he put the onus exclusively on Israel and not on the Palestinians. I mean, one of the things I say is that he treated the Palestinians as if they were too weak to criticize. And my approach has been, I want to hold both sides accountable. I don't mind holding the Israelis accountable, but it can't be you hold the Israelis accountable and you never hold the Palestinians accountable. And if the Israelis, if the Palestinians are too weak to criticize, they're too weak to be accountable. If they're too weak to be accountable, they're too weak to have a state. You don't make it easier for the Palestinians to do what they have to do particularly at a time when they have a political culture shaped by a profound sense of grievance, by deep anger, by a sense that they're the party that is owed. In that kind of environment, the idea of making concessions to the stronger party, Israel, is something that's seen as illegitimate. Now, there's no peace agreement unless they also have to compromise. So if the political culture makes it illegitimate to compromise, and then when they have a chance to when they're presented something, which they were presented by the president in March of 2014, a set of principles to solve the conflict, and they don't respond, and you don't criticize them, why would they ever change their behavior? So this was an area of difference that I had and that I spell out in the chapter.
Several of the questions ask about the two-state solution. And let me read just two of these questions for you to respond to. Is there a future for the two-state solution, or is that idea long gone? That's one question. Another question is, so what is the path to a two-state solution?
Well, obviously, two good questions. As hopeless as it seems right now, you can't give up on a two-state outcome because there's no alternative to it. It's not just that I said, if you like a one-state outcome, then, you know, the daily violence that you see, that's your future. That's what you're going to have. There is, by the way, if you look at the Middle East, there is no state in the Middle East that is at peace internally that has more than one identity. So you want to apply that model to this and say, okay, let's have a binational state. It means what you want is a continuing, ongoing war between Israelis and Palestinians. So it's not like you have an alternative. The problem is, how do you get from where we are to a two-state outcome? And it's very difficult because right now the Palestinians are so weak and so dysfunctional, they're not capable of doing anything. They can't negotiate, and if there was a negotiation, they couldn't make any compromises. So where does that leave you? I think right now, first you have to be smart about what you're prepared to do, meaning you can't now make your objective, well, we're going to go and solve the whole conflict. Because right now the gap between the two sides, the level of disbelief between the two sides is so great, any major initiative at this point is going to fail. And then you simply deepen the cynicism. So what do you need to do? First, focus on how do you calm the environment. Two, what can you do to restore a sense of possibility? We have completely lost any sense of possibility that you can actually produce a peace between Israelis and Palestinians. You have to restore that. I've been making suggestions for a while that focus on how do you deal with the source of disbelief. Each side disbelieves that the other is committed to two states. Israelis look at Palestinians and say, you know, they reject the very idea of a state of the Jewish people. You know, so there's no way that what the Palestinians want is a Palestinian state and a binational state. Palestinians say, if the Israelis believe in two states, how come they build in what would be our state? So you have to deal with the sources of disbelief. And, you know, I have favored the idea of having an agenda for discussions between the two sides, having a series of either steps or gestures or statements they would make that would deal with the why each side looks at the other and says they don't believe in two states. So the examples I give are Israel would announce that it's going to make its settlement policy consistent with a two-state outcome. It wouldn't build in what would be the Palestinian state. It realizes it still has to negotiate a border, but until it can negotiate a border, it won't build in what it thinks will be the Palestinian state, meaning to the east of the security barrier. Israel might give incentives to those who live outside the barrier to move back into the settlement blocks or into Israel. Israel might also begin building housing for those who would be moving back. Those three steps alone would demonstrate a commitment to two states. The Palestinians might agree that they'll put Israel on a map. Pretty hard to convince any Israeli that the Palestinians really believe in a two-state outcome when there are no Palestinian Authority maps that show Israel. Maybe the Palestinians could accept the idea that both sides have hard decisions to make as a way of indicating that they understand they have to make compromise too. Maybe the Palestinians could acknowledge there's two national movements and that's why you need two states for two peoples. I mean, these are the kind of things that if you could get an exchange on these ideas, and I actually have several others, that you might begin to restore a process of believing things could happen. On top of that, I would take some specific steps on the ground. Obviously, what I said about on the Israeli side on the issue of settlements, that would be one thing. But the Israelis could open up Area C, which is 60% of the West Bank. They could open it up to Palestinian economic activity. They could open it up to Palestinian housing. There's an acute Palestinian shortage of housing. Those are things that could make a difference. Maybe in response to that, the Palestinians could agree that they, you know, they wouldn't be pressing at the International Criminal Court against the Israelis. I mean, the point is, you need to do some things on the ground that will change the climate and restore a sense of possibility. Without that, no peace initiative has any chance of success. Now, the third thing you do probably can't be done right now. I think we have to broaden the scope of the negotiations so that the Arab states are now a part of the negotiations with the Israelis and the Palestinians. Palestinians don't have the ability to make any compromises, but compromise has to be made. So the Arab states would have to assume the responsibility of the cover for those compromises. The Israelis would be prepared, I think, to make compromises towards the Palestinians if they got something from the Arabs in return. So the Arabs provide both the cover for the Palestinians and they provide a justification to the Israeli public that compromises towards the Palestinians will yield something from the Arabs.
You know, we're coming to the end of our time with Dennis, and this is a great question, and it'll be interesting to see how a real diplomat responds to this question, and perhaps we can end with this. But after Ambassador Ross answers this question, please remember that our friends in the Book Den have copies of the new book, Doomed to Succeed, in the foyer, and Ambassador Ross will be here afterward to sign your copy. Now, I want to see how a diplomat answers this. This is really going to be fun. This is a great question. And I want to know who wrote this question, okay? Come up afterwards and tell me, all right? So here it is. You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. If asked, would you serve in a Hillary White House? Isn't that great?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll answer it as a diplomat would. I have never yet turned down a job I have not been offered.
Very good. Well, very good. Dennis, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
For coming to Santa Barbara again.
My pleasure.
Join me in thanking Ambassador Ross.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.